Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Nadia Salerno Sonnenberg. She performs Brooks' first violin concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Kimmel Center this evening. Susan Lewis takes us to America I Am, a new exhibition at the National Constitution Center that explores the myriad contributions of African Americans to the history of the United States. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Arden Theater in Philadelphia as it premieres an adaptation of Haim Potok's 1972 novel, My Name is Asher Lev. And David Patrick Stearns profiles singing sensation Eric Owens. Despite a stellar international career, the Philadelphia-born bass baritone still finds time to regularly perform in his hometown. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Acclaimed violinist Nadia Salerno Sonnenberg's relationship with the Philadelphia Orchestra goes back more than three decades. She made her solo debut with the ensemble when she was just 10. Although a virtuosic performer in all genres and periods, Miss Salerno Sonnenberg has, in recent years, been increasing her focus on contemporary music, commissioning and performing works by many living composers. This week, she returned to Philadelphia for performances of Brooks' joyful and ever-popular First Concerto. And when we caught up with her backstage at the Kimmel Center, I asked her what effect performing so much new music has had on her interpretations of more seasoned fare.
It has been wonderful for me. It makes for a very varied season. And that's a very good thing for an artist like me. And how it's wonderful is that when I come back to the bread and butter, the war horses, they are even fresher than before. I have never really had a big problem with keeping a piece fresh. If the piece is great, I mean, play any solo violinist, how many times would they have played Mendelssohn Concerto in their lives? You probably can't count it. You know, it's probably the most popular violin concerto. But I still discover things. And even if I don't discover something new in any particular performance, it's such a phenomenal work that I don't really have a problem breathing life into it. It's like, you know, how many times in your life have you eaten pizza? Probably a lot. Doesn't mean you don't like that slice you're having tonight, right? So, I mean, if something is good, it's good. That's it. And if you relate to it. So for me, though, this is an added bonus by playing all this other kind of repertoire to come back to these pieces. It's as if you've taken 100 performances away. They're that new again. And the style of playing them is new again. And now, in fact, I'm a music director of New Century Chamber Orchestra in San Francisco. And so there's even a lot of different rep going on. So my season is extraordinarily varied now, repertoire-wise.
This Brooke Violin Concerto you're performing is quite astonishingly popular. I think in surveys from one of the British national radio stations, it's been voted the most popular classical music piece over the last 5 years. Can you work out why this is?
It's funny, actually, that you mention a British publication saying that, because I remember quite some time ago I was scheduled to play the prom concerts in London, and it's just a huge event. And it was one of the concerts in the summer called The Nation's Favorite. And basically they took a poll, a vote, and the orchestra played and the soloist played what the nation wanted, and they wanted Brooke. So they love it there, UK, the Brooke. You know, I think any piece that there's a reason for these pieces that last and the test of time. I mean, it's a real gem. It really is. It's a piece that we violinists learn when we're young. But when you play it as you get older and the more you play it, it just becomes you start to see things that you just couldn't possibly see as a student. And no matter the depth that happens in your life and the experiences that happen in your life, when you play this piece, somehow it yields to that. It gives you a way of expressing everything that you feel and everything that you've learned and everything that you've experienced. So in that way, it's quite gratifying to play it as well. I can't say it's necessarily the strength of the composer, because there are certain concertos that you can only do so much with. You can only put so much of your own stamp into it. And the Brooke is not one of those pieces. So I think that the listener can hear 100 different versions of Brooke. Very, very different. You know, you're hearing the same notes, but the emotion behind it and the excitement behind it can be something very, very different depending on who's playing it.
What is it saying to you at the moment?
It's an old friend. The piece is an old friend, and I have always I remember loving it a lot when I was learning it as a student. It's phenomenal for me to play it here with the Philly Orchestra because my teacher, I'm looking at her while I'm playing it, and I learned it with her. So that's a very special experience for me, and it's like a very old friend that you've known all your life, and they complete your sentences. And so the Bruch is that for me. You know, it's a pleasure to play it, and you know, with Philly, I mean, it's always a joy to play here.
An old friend with an old friend.
That's right. With a very old friend, exactly.
Nadia Salerna Sonnenberg. She performs Bruch's Violin Concerto No. 1 with the Philadelphia Orchestra this evening at 8 at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. The concert, conducted by Christoph Eschenbach, also features Bruckner's Symphony No. 6.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This week, Barack Obama will become President of the United States, the first African-American to hold this highest office. In the centuries prior to this historic day, despite years of enslavement and decades of incomplete protection under law, African Americans have been helping shape America. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to America I Am, the African American Imprint, a new exhibition at the National Constitution Center.
In 1903, the African American scholar and political activist W.E.B. Du Bois posed a question about American identity, echoed today over 100 years later by the exhibition's presenter, the broadcaster Tavis Smiley.
Would America have been America without her Negro people?
This thought is the premise for America I Am, conceived by Smiley after a visit to Jamestown, Virginia, where a Dutch ship brought the first African-American slaves in the early 1600s. Smiley says Du Bois' question provides a good starting point for telling African-American history in a new way.
Trying to answer that question in terms of the imprint that African Americans have had on this place called America, culturally, economically, spiritually, politically.
A team of 44 scholars on a range of subjects came on board as advisors. John Fleming, Director Emeritus of Museums at the Cincinnati Museum Center, currently the president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, signed on as executive producer and began a widespread search for artifacts.
For example, I came to Philadelphia looking to get a gown of Marian Anderson. They didn't have any. But someone told me, why don't you go down to Richmond? There's a little museum. They had 6 gowns down there.
And so one discovery led to another.
When I was talking with the National Park Service, they said, well, you should include James Dexter. He had a house under the parking lot here at the National Constitution Center. He had a connection with St. Thomas Church. That led me up to St. Thomas Church, and I found out that they had the original altar that Absalom Jones put in the church in 1792. And then on top of that, they had records of the Free African Society, and no one ever thought that any of those records existed.
The resulting history, called America I Am, the African American Imprint, dovetails with the overarching theme of the National Constitution Center itself, the story of the three words that begin the U.S. Constitution, We the People.
That struggle over who's we has been something that has been with us from the beginning.
Constitution Center President Joe Torsella.
And it's the story of how we have defined that and how Americans have struggled to be included in that and how that definition has grown broader and stronger and better over time. This exhibit is really in the sweet spot for us.
America I Am presents the African-American story in a journey through 12 connecting galleries. Just beyond the entrance, a hallway, where images of African Americans appear to fall into shadow as a visitor walks past, leads back in time to a room representing Africa. John Fleming says it was important to start in Africa, for while enslaved people couldn't bring objects with them, they brought their knowledge and skills.
African culture changed as it encountered European culture. European culture changed as it encountered African culture. And what emerged was a new American culture, and it began during the colonial period and blossomed in the 21st century.
Over 300 artifacts are interspersed with artwork, murals, film footage, and text panels that pinpoint historical milestones in the journey to today's America. Each gallery creates a different environment, with dramatic lighting, ambient sounds, and in some cases, theatrical set design. Mark Locke is Senior Vice President of Arts and Exhibitions International, the company that created the show.
A theatrical presentation is important to put people there. The artifacts, the stories will always be the focus, but anytime you can put them in context, put you there a little bit, then I think it's even more meaningful.
After leaving Africa, visitors walk past the actual doors of no return from the Cape Coast Castle in Ghana into a small, dark space, conjuring up the idea of a dungeon holding area. Several rooms beyond, a handwritten letter guaranteeing free passage to Frederick Douglass, and a cotton gin set against a stone wall with crickets in the background help tell about the time of the Underground Railroad. Further along, the actual stool and key sit in front of recreated jail doors depicting the cell from which Martin Luther King wrote his letter from a Birmingham jail.
Let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities.
Everyday accessories of ordinary people are intermingled with belongings of the famous. Phyllis Wheatley's writing desk, the typewriter that Alex Haley used to type Roots, Muhammad Ali's robe, Jackie Robinson's jersey, and the rock star Prince's purple guitar. Bits of every part of life, music and the arts, entertainment and sports, politics, the military and the church, come together to tell the history of African Americans. It is a story of America. Constitution Center President Joe Torsella says this exhibition speaks to the essence of American civic identity.
In this long struggle for full liberty and inclusion, the African-American journey has become the American journey, and in the struggle to be part of full citizenship, it's helped create a better kind of citizenship for everyone.
Near the end of the show, autographed in an open notebook, sits Barack Obama's now famous speech on race, delivered at the Constitution Center in March.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, 221 years ago.
One advisor to America I Am is Princeton professor Cornel West, who cautions that however celebratory the exhibition's closing gallery, the struggle is not over, and we must continue to keep track of all our people, especially the poor.
No matter what color the president, because what this is about justice, it's about truth, and that cuts much deeper than any pigmentation or skin color.
And this exhibition gives the sense that the story has a beginning and a middle, but it's not an ending story.
Yeah, that's right. It's incomplete. Like any great democratic experiment, it's unfinished and incomplete. It's open-ended. It depends on what we do right now, and that's our challenge.
Would America have been America without her African-American people? American music without the soul of jazz, the harmony of Motown, or the beat of rock and roll? Without Duke Ellington, Marian Anderson, or Jimi Hendrix? American sports without Jackie Robinson or Michael Jordan? Poetry and literature without Maya Angelou, Langston Hughes, and Ralph Ellison? Would America be the land of opportunity without the quiet courage of Rosa Parks or the vision of Martin Luther King? Clearly not. They are of us, and we all are of them. We, the people.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. America I Am, the African American imprint, is at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia through May 3rd. In 1999, the Arden Theatre Company in Philadelphia premiered an adaptation of the late Haim Potok's novel The Chosen, an award-winning bestseller about a friendship and rivalry between two Jewish boys. That play has now been produced over 40 times, with future productions still planned in South Africa and Brazil. This week, the Arden Theatre opens a new staging of another Potok book. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the coming-of-age story that explores faith and art wasn't originally a strong candidate for adaptation.
Aaron Posner, who co-founded the Arden, adapted both The Chosen and the theater's latest play, My Name is Asher Lev. The project springs from Posner's deep appreciation for the internationally celebrated author Haim Potok, who made his home just outside of Philadelphia, studied at the University of Pennsylvania, and died in 2002. Potok wrote many novels, plays, children's books, and other nonfiction works, all informed by his Orthodox Jewish background. Posner finds Potok to be an exceptional storyteller, but not a flashy and clever one.
I am certainly drawn to more pyrotechnic writers at times and people who are achieve spectacular literary effect and where the language is sort of rich and evocative in certain, like, highly theatrical ways. And that's not Potok. That's not what he did. His language is plain and simple in some ways and very direct. But I think that that directness, that sort of open-handed approach to writing, carries a powerful both emotional, intellectual, and spiritual impact.
When Posner adapted The Chosen at the Arden 10 years ago, he worked closely with Potok. During that time, they began discussions about how the 1972 novel My Name is Asher Lev might be brought to the stage. The story centers on a child artist prodigy born into a Hasidic Jewish family. His parents view his art as foolish, even sacrilegious. As Asher grows and develops as an artist, so grows his conflict and desire to honor his family and community while being true to himself and his gift as a painter. According to Adina Potok, Haim Potok's wife of 44 years, the inspiration for the Asher Lev story is rooted in Potok's own experience as a child, when he discovered a love and talent for painting, but his father demanded he stop. Potok wondered what would have happened if he hadn't complied with his father's wishes and had continued to paint. Adina Potok recalls her husband writing the book feverishly through the summer of 1971.
He just about finished it when we were in Jerusalem that summer. He really tucked it in when we came back. And then I remember bringing it over to Bob Gottlieb, who was then editor at Knopf. And Bob sat up, and he went to his room or whatever, he did his reading, and he sat and he read through the night. And we kind of dozed a little bit in chairs. And then Bob came and he said, "It's a book."
A book that went on to be a success, commonly found on high school reading lists and now on the theater stage.
My name is Asher Lev, the son of Arya and Rivka Lev. I am an observant Jew. I am an artist.
Three actors portray the many characters of the novel on stage, with Carl Miller playing Asher. Consolidating all the personalities of the story is just one aspect of how Aaron Posner adapted the story for theater. Initially, Posner thought Asher Lev defied adaptation.
It covers about 20 years in a person's life. The conflict is not extravagant, but internal and emotional. It deals with, you know, a famously difficult thing for movies or plays. It deals with the visual arts. So how do you make, like, oh, I drew? How do you make that inherently dramatic? It's not a terribly dramatic thing, something that takes a long time. It's like trying to make studying dramatic. You know, these are tricky.
Posner has extensively consulted with Adina Potok throughout his writing process. And a few years ago, he enlisted the help of Michelle Volansky, a dramaturg who often works with playwrights to develop new pieces. She was wary of an adaptation.
I read the book and felt like it was virtually impossible that was never, ever going to happen.
In Volansky's experience, translating internal expressions of faith to the stage is especially complicated.
How do you express devotion? How do you express praying? How do you express that deep fervency that Asher has?
Yet some of the things that are difficult to bring to life on stage are the very topics that make Potok's stories compelling. Faith, art, loyalty, authenticity. Much of Potok's writings explore the friction between religion, in particular Judaism, and the values of modern secular culture. Adina Potok says her husband wanted to encourage respect for differing viewpoints.
He was not presenting good against evil. He was presenting a good in conflict with another good. And how do we deal with it? How do we deal with it within a family? How do we deal with it with friends? How do we deal with it in communities?
My Name is Asher Lev embraces the gray areas, according to Michelle Volansky.
So many different kinds of stories, so many different kinds of movies, plays, television present the world and the decisions that we have to make in it in black and white terms. And this book is 30 years old, and it completely anticipates the grayness with which we exist today.
In addition to being the adapter, Aaron Posner directs the Arden Theater production of Asher Lev. From his multifaceted perspective, Posner says Haim Potok's compelling ideas are ultimately what make the story work on stage.
For me, it's all about, and this is a word I've co-opted from Haim Potok, from The Chosen. He talks a lot about doing things that are worthwhile, that are truly worthwhile. And I think this is a story that is worth hearing, is worth telling, is worth reimagining, is worth re-exploring. So because the story is worthwhile, if that's true, I think you can always find a way to bring it to life on stage.
A story written 37 years ago now has new life on stage. An unlikely transformation that aims to provoke new thoughts about an old conflict.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. My Name Is Asher Lev is at the Arden Theatre in Old City, Philadelphia through March 15th. The commanding bass baritone of Philadelphia-born and educated Eric Owens is now heard in the opera capitals of the world, most recently this season at the Metropolitan Opera in Mozart's Magic Flute and John Adams' Dr. Atomic. Somehow that hasn't translated into Philadelphia hearing any less of him. He's singing a recital on Tuesday for the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society, another on March 22nd at the Settlement Music School, and then two subscription concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Bigger coups are down the road. He'll star in the Met's hotly anticipated new production of Das Rheingold in 2010. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns catches up with Owens at his alma mater, the Curtis Institute of Music.
Traditional opera roles have given bass baritone Eric Owens a nice career. The Opera Company of Philadelphia, for example, and lots of other desirable places. What took him to the very top of his profession, however, is what many singers dread and avoid. Contemporary music. Besides singing John Adams' Dr. Atomic in San Francisco, Amsterdam, and New York, he plays a benevolent narrator in Adams' A Flowering Tree, which was his ticket to a high-profile recording on Nonesuch that's heard here.
One morning, working in the heat and glare of the summer sun.
As well as performances with Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic. After years of hard work, the 38-year-old Owens suddenly realized he'd arrived.
It was such a kick. I had, while we were doing that, there were a few moments where I had to like smack myself. It's like, okay, stop basking in, oh my God, there's Simon Rattle and I'm standing up here with the Berlin Philharmonic. But it was such a blast because it was unbelievable. I mean, just thinking of, you know, where I've come from, and in a way it just makes no sense. Just that I, you know, like my parents weren't professional musicians, or, you know, there's not a pedigree sort of a thing, you know, and that my whole interest in opera was piqued when I was about 10 years old, just listening to it on the radio. Nobody really had to sort of introduce me to it, or, you know, with me, it's just sort of like sort of odd thing.
Strangely enough, Eric Owens's musical evolution began with the oboe. Vera Wilson, founder of Astral Artists, advised the mature Owens on his singing career, but also knew him from before in area youth orchestras.
Eric Owens, as a teenage oboist, was a really wonderful musician. He had the passion, he had the sensitivity, and that's what I thought he was going to be doing. Until, in the hallways of the YMCA, where the Youth Orchestra, Philadelphia Youth Orchestra, used to rehearse, I started hearing the sounds of his voice, and so did many others. And they started suggesting to him that he should consider going into voice.
That happened when he was in his early 20s at Temple University. From the beginning of his vocal career, he didn't take the obvious route. Usually singers save art song recitals for when they're established. Owens sang them from the beginning, from airy, semi-whispered French repertoire, such as this Reynaldo Hahn song, to dark, difficult, uncompromising Hugo Wolf, often, he admits, reflecting his less-than-cheery moods.
One needs to do music and poetry that speaks to them. I remember getting feedback from people, and some people loved it, some people were like, man, I wanted to kill myself after that. What were you trying to do to us? And I'm just like, what? That's, hey, you know, that's what it was. And so, yeah. Until the next thing where I'm feeling, you know, upbeat or funny and, you know, want to do that.
His Tuesday recital moves into the Fyodor Shalyapin zone. That legendary Russian bass was considered one of the great singing actors of his time. And though Owens has no designs on the opera roles that made Shalyapin famous, he's exploring music from his 1933 film The Adventures of Don Quixote, written to tap into the Russian singer's keen sense of theater, which Owens has also discovered within himself.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Owens became an inventive actor out of necessity. He turned to the movie Beetlejuice for inspiration in playing the legendary monster Grendel in the new Elliot Goldenthal opera of the same name. It brought light to his character's eternal shade. In Dr. Atomic, he played the imposing, cranky General Leslie Groves, who gives orders to everything and everybody, including the rainstorm that threatened to cancel the first atomic bomb test.
This test will proceed as scheduled. With full weather compliance, or you will spend the rest of your life behind bars, Mr. Meteorologist.
Surprise comes in the private moments Owens brings to the camera. Just before the blast, the scientists are eating chocolate to calm their nerves. When the calorie-counting Groves was handed a giant Hershey bar, Owens looked both ways to see who was watching, and then, like a shy little mouse, began nibbling.
He is a complete product of Philadelphia schooling, whether it's Central High, Settlement, Temple, then Curtis, then Astral. It's just a very rewarding feeling for me to know that everybody's investment paid off.
Maybe it's paid off a little too well. Suddenly, Owens has ambitions beyond the opera stage and the recital platform. He's learning to be a conductor?
Why? Because it's something that I really enjoy, just delving into scores that deeply. And I'm sort of, you know, working slowly, you know, and thinking maybe in the next 3 to 5 years to, you know, start. You know, I'm always, even though I'm watching the conductor, I'm always listening to the orchestra and how I fit in as an instrument of that ensemble, even as a singer on the stage.
The world doesn't have plenty of Wagnerian basses. The world has plenty of conductors. Will somebody please stop him before he succeeds at that too?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Eric Owens in tomorrow's paper. Owens is in recital for the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society at the American Philosophical Society on Tuesday at 8. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.